Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
There's a scene in a movie some years ago, a movie about Charles Darwin called Creation, where Darwin decides to write a book on his theory of evolution. And in the scene he says, I will call my book The Origin of Species. I will keep God out of it. The origin of everything without God. And maybe that's where you're at today. And just the concept of an unseen deity speaking the world into existence, flinging the stars into outer space and sculpting the planets and earth and breathing life into the first man and first woman. It sounds made-believe, you know. It sounds like mythology. And I understand that. In some ways, it does seem kind of far-fetched to me. Except the alternative to that scenario, the idea that everything came about into existence without a creator, well, that raises some really challenging questions in my mind as well. And all of that is what we're going to talk about today as we continue our new series we started last week, in which we're trying to look at intellectual reasons for faith. And in this series, it's not like science versus faith. I think faith supports science. Science supports faith. Now, in case you weren't here last week, let me just kind of catch you up at what we're trying to accomplish. We are talking about possibly taking one step per week. Last week, in addition to seeing an incredible impersonation of a turtle, remember that? If you weren't here, you missed it, and you ain't never seen it again. It was awesome. But in addition to that, I asked, if you're an atheist, if you would consider taking the chance, taking the step of deciding that instead of believing like an atheist does, that there is no God, there is no chance there is a God, of taking the step of becoming an agnostic. An agnostic says, I'm not sure if there's a God or not. I asked you last week to consider the possibility that you cannot be sure that no God exists. For instance, last week we talked about the origin of the universe, and we said that no matter what you believe about that, it's a faith decision on your part. You have faith that God did it, or you have faith that there is no God who did it. No one was there to see it when it happened. We can't put it into a lab. We can't repeat it. And so the scientific method does not apply to that question. And so the conclusion we come to about the origin of the universe, we have to come through faith. We can look at evidence, but in the end, it's a faith decision. You might have faith in an eternal God who started it all, or you might have faith in an eternal universe. You might have faith that everything sprung forth from God, or that everything sprung forth from nothing. But either way, it is a faith decision on your part. You just can't know for sure. This week, I want to ask you to consider possibly taking one more step, the step from being an agnostic who feels like it's unknowable whether there's a God or not, to becoming a deist who believes that the idea of a God, that there is a God, is at least probable. That they may not necessarily believe in the God of the Bible, but they believe there must be a God, a higher intelligence out there somewhere. So I need to admit to you, I'm not like a total expert on all this. There are like huge volumes of books that have been written about what we're going to discuss today. I don't have all the knowledge, and especially I don't have enough time to really do this justice, but I'm going to at least try to give you some ideas to think about. When you're putting together a puzzle, it's easier if you can like look at the picture on the box and then start working on the puzzle. So let me kind of give you the big picture view, the bottom line of where we're going today. The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. That's today's idea. The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. Think of it this way. Let's say I sat down to eat breakfast to a bowl of Alphabet cereal. Do you remember Alphabet cereal? All the pieces of cereal, all little letters, right? And I sit down, I look in my bowl, and I see an A and then a T side by side. I might think, look at that, there's like a little word in my cereal, cool. If I saw A-R-T, I'd be a little more surprised. If I saw F-A-R-T, T, I am getting out my phone, I am taking pictures, I am posting them online. If I saw VINCEISABIGFART spelled out in my bowl, I am gonna find my wife, I'm gonna ask her why she's mad at me, how did she do that with my cereal, and is the best way to communicate with me really through cereal? I mean, right? Because A-R-T might by chance float and form a word together, but there is no way, we all know, there's no way an entire sentence would form in my bowl by random chance. Someone with intelligence, with intentionality, would have had to have done that. Because the more complex a design, the more likely a designer. Even if you just put the 15 letters of that sentence, Vince is a big fart. I've never said that out loud. I don't like saying that, it turns out. If you just put those letters in a box, shook them up, dumped them out, they're not going to form in the right order and the right sequence to make that sentence, right? I mean, you could do it millions of times, and they're never going to form that sentence. And so if you see that sentence made up by letters, there's a pretty safe bet that someone wrote the words. The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. There was a movie back in the 90s you might remember called Contact. Starred Jodie Foster as a fictional scientist who was part of a real-life organization called SETI, S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. These scientists, what they do is they scan outer space, just listening for messages that might provide a sign that there is intelligent life out there somewhere. Well, in the movie, she hears something that captures her attention. It's radio waves that have a numerical pattern. 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11. And she recognizes, wait, those are the primary numbers. Those are prime numbers. And the message ends up containing all the prime numbers from 1 to 101. And she immediately recognizes this cannot be random chance, nature. No, this is a sign that there is intelligent life out there. Why? The pattern was far too specific to be random. The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. So let's think about our universe and the incredible complexity of design that we see. It's just staggering. I like the way it's put in the Bible in a book called Romans in chapter 1, verse 20. By the way, we're going to put all the Bible verses on the screen for you. And if you don't own a Bible, we would love to give you one today. We give them out for free back at the Velcro Bar. We got English Bibles. Grab a Bible today. So it says this: ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. It's saying, if you look at the universe, the majesty of it all, it just points to a powerful designer God. In fact, it's arguing that there is something inside of us that knows, that just knows that this world is just too complex, nature is too profound for this to be a random accident, and it should lead us to the conclusion that our world is not a random accident, that there must be a creator. The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. So some would say, yeah, the world is complex, but the reason is evolution. Last week we said it, and by the way, if you missed last week, you can watch or listen to that on the Verve website or the Verve app, free and all. So last week we said that before we can talk about evolution, we first have to address the more foundational question of origins, and we did that last week. Let's talk a little bit about evolution today. I want to explain two terms to make sure that we're all on the same page. There are two types of evolution. There's what's called macroevolution, and there's microevolution. So I absolutely believe in microevolution. I can't imagine anyone possibly not believing in microevolution. Microevolution is the transformation that happens within a species over time. So like, for instance, over time, we know that humans have become taller, and stronger than they used to be. That's microevolution, the species developing. Perhaps there used to be just one kind of maple tree. But today, you look around the world, we have red maples, swamp maples, sugar maples, black maples, Marla maples. You remember she was married to Donald Trump for a while? And all of that would be microevolution, except for the Marla maples part. If a tree became Marla maples, that would be macroevolution, which we'll talk about in a second. But the rest, becoming different sorts of the same species, that is an evolutionary development within a species, a process of natural selection that helps a species to adapt to its environment over time. Macroevolution is different. Macroevolution says that all living things all evolved from one common ancestor, from single-celled organisms. In fact, macroevolution would go back even further and say that those first living cells, that before that, somewhere in the distant past, there was something that's called prehistoric goo, and that goo led to a single-cell living organism. And somehow, basically, that goo sprang to life and became a single-celled living organism. And over time, macroevolution would say that single organism led to a fish, led to an amphibian, which led to a mammal, which led to a monkey, which led to Donald Trump, who was married to Marla Maples. And it led to all of Donald Trump's other wives and all of his kids and you and me. So macroevolution would say we all, every living thing, all evolved from prehistoric goo. Starting with the research of Charles Darwin, microevolution has been proven. Macroevolution was kind of scientists taking a logical leap from microevolution. Like, well, you know, if a species can evolve, then one species must be able to evolve into another. There is abundant evidence for microevolution. It's demonstrable fact. There is no definitive proof for macroevolution. It's just a theory. Charles Darwin said, if his theory of macroevolution was correct, he said the fossil record, you know, we dig up fossils from the ground of old animals and dinosaurs. He said it would contain countless examples of what he called transitional forms, proof of links between two different species. And so we would find fossils that were kind of like half this and half that. And so it was kind of in the middle of evolving. And we'd have an example. See, here's something in the middle of evolving from one species to another. Well, fossils like that had not been discovered when he first published The Origin of Species in 1859, but he believed that they would be discovered one day. In fact, he said tons of them will have to be discovered if my theory is true. Here we are 150 years later, and it still hasn't happened. Fossils continue to be found all the time, but they are fossils of fully developed and fully distinct species of plants and animals. And so there's no proof that one species has ever transitioned into a different species. And anyone who has done any research and is intellectually honest at all would agree with that. They'd say, yes, we don't have that proof yet. Now, you may have had a science teacher who said that the fact that skeletons of monkeys and humans, the fact that they're so similar, proves that humans evolved from monkeys. They would say, that's the proof. Monkeys and humans have very similar skeletons, and so it proves that we evolved from monkeys. No, it doesn't. It doesn't prove anything. Isn't it possible that all it does is show that the same designer designed both monkeys and man, and maybe he just thought the same structure would be good for both. That's a belief that many creation scientists hold to, that perhaps common traits point to a common designer rather than a common ancestor. And the truth is, we see that all the time. So like, if you were to look at all the paintings of Monet, or if you were to look at Saturday Evening Post covers by Norman Rockwell, or photographs by Ansel Adams, or if you were to listen to different songs by Metallica, like uh-huh Or song two. Song three. And song four. That really, I did that just to pump myself up. It's like, whoa, now I'm ready. All right, we can do this. But if you listen to that, you're like, hey, wait a second. I noticed there's a similarity between those songs. Yeah, I noticed a similarity between those paintings of Monet. Yeah, it's because the same artist designed them. And so, of course, there's similarity, right? And perhaps that's what God did too. It makes sense. I mentioned a minute ago, I said creation scientists, which may have surprised some of you. Some people are under the impression that all scientists don't believe in God. There's no such thing as a scientist who believes in God. All scientists believe in macro evolution. No, that is not true at all. There are many scientists who are Christians and who believe that God created the world. For instance, Francis Collins is one of the most accomplished scientists in the world. He was the head of the Human Genome Project, and he's so respected that our nation appointed him the director of the National Institutes of Health. What that means is he is a science rock star, and he's a Christian. And he argues very passionately and persuasively that there must be a designer God behind all of this. In his books, one of them is called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. And he is not alone at all. There's another scientist, his name is Owen Gingerich. He is a Harvard University astronomy professor and the senior astronomer at the Smithsonian Observatory. He says this: a common sense and satisfying interpretation of our world suggests the designing hand of super intelligence. What he's saying is, man, you just look at the world and you just use your common sense, and it's like there had to be an intelligent, intentional designer behind this all. All right, I said I don't have enough time to cover this thoroughly, so I gotta move quick and talk even faster than I normally talk. With the time I have left, I wanna kinda give you two views as we think about the design of the universe, kind of a big picture view and a close-up view. We could say a telescope view and a microscope view. So we'll start with the telescope view. I love this passage in the Old Testament of the Bible. A guy named King David wrote in Psalm 19, "The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. Day after day they continue to speak. Night after night they make him known. They speak without a sound or a word. Their voice is never heard, yet their message has gone throughout the earth and their words to all the world." The idea is that, man, you look up to the heavens and you realize, man, there's so much. There's the stars and the moon and the sun and the vastness of the universe. And you just kind of get this sense of awe and wonder of the natural world. And it's like, man, there's got to be someone behind this, you know? Like we could talk about the vastness of our universe. So our Earth revolves around the sun. If the Earth were the size of a golf ball, just for a point of comparison, let's pretend the Earth was the size of a golf ball, then the sun would be 15 feet in diameter. It's massive compared to the Earth. But our sun is actually a relatively puny star compared to many others. One of the brightest stars in the night sky is Betelgeuse. And if the Earth were the size of a golf ball, the diameter of Betelgeuse would be equal to 6 times the height of the Empire State Building. Huge. There's a star called Canis Majoris. It is the brightest star we see in the night sky. If the Earth were the size of a golf ball, the diameter of Canis Majoris would be the size of Mount Everest. And like Psalm 19 says, you just look at just all of it, and when it comes to the sky, just the natural wonder of the world, and it makes you suspect, man, there's just got to be a designer. It makes you suspect that. It doesn't prove it, but here's something that might convince you that there has to be an intelligent, intentional designer. It's called the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle. It refers to the fact that our Earth was perfectly designed to support human life. There's a scientist named Dr. Robert Collins. He earned his PhD in physics from the University of Texas and in philosophy from the University of Notre Dame. He has done years and years of research and analysis and become an outspoken advocate for the design, not random chance, but the design of the universe. And he suggests that the fine-tuning of the universe is the most persuasive argument for the existence of God. He uses an illustration to explain this, and it makes it maybe a little easier to understand. He says, suppose one day we have astronauts who are able to land on Mars. Okay, and so they're exploring Mars, and on Mars, they find a domed structure, and they realize it's a biosphere. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, they created a dome structure that's in Arizona, and so that is a biosphere. It's perfectly created to sustain life. And so suppose they found that on Mars, okay, that was sitting on Mars, and they examined it, they realized it was perfectly situated, perfectly designed to sustain human life. I mean, oxygen, temperature, gravity, humidity, lots of food, energy, everything was set perfect to sustain human life. Consider on top of that, as they study it, they realize that if any one of the systems of that biosphere were thrown off, it was designed so that the change would immediately undermine all the other systems. Collins says if scientists discovered a biosphere like that on Mars, they would know beyond any doubt that someone intelligent had taken care to create, to design and build that structure. There's no way that something like that could be labeled a random accident. It couldn't have happened just by chance. Well, guess what? That is exactly the structure of our world, only on a much grander, much more amazing scale. In the past few decades, it has become increasingly and amazingly clear just how perfect our part of the universe is for sustaining life. So for instance, our Earth sits 93 million miles from the sun. This is 93 million miles. If we were just a few thousand miles further from the sun, so out of 93 million miles, just a couple thousand miles further, all the water on Earth would freeze and we couldn't live here. Or if we were just a couple thousand miles closer to the sun, all the water would evaporate. We couldn't live here. Oxygen makes up 21% of our atmosphere. If it were just a little bit less, like 15%, we would all suffocate. If it was just a little bit more, like 25%, fires would erupt spontaneously all the time. Like we would be sitting here right now and I'd be like, fire, whoa, like fire. Like it would just be like on the stage all over the place. There would be fires. You guys did not appreciate the gusto I just put into the whole fire. Like you don't even pretend. You don't care. Oh, you don't care about my acting. The moon is the exact perfect distance from the sun to maintain proper tidal effects on Earth without throwing off our climate. There's example after example after example. There's another scientist. His name is Dr. Hugh Ross, bunch of great books he's written. He's an astrophysicist. And what he says is there are 122, what he calls constants, key factors that together kind of constitute this anthropic principle. And so that keep us living here on Earth, these 122 factors. He says the possibility of any one planet having all these necessary constants without some sort of intentional, intelligent design is like virtually impossible. So here's the numbers, and these are hard for me to get my head around. I'm guessing it'll be hard for you too. I'm going to show you. This is approximately the amount of planets in our universe. Okay, that's how many planets there are in our universe. That number is 10 trillion trillion, okay? Here is, according to the scientists, the possibility of just one planet having all 122 constants necessary to support life on that planet is one out of, I don't know what to call that number. We'll call it a bunch, right? That is the bajillion, right? That's a lot, right? It's a bunch. And so these scientists are coming to the conclusion that the amazing design of our universe, of our galaxy, of our solar system, of our planet points to a very intelligent, very intentional designer. That's the big view, the telescope view. Now let's kind of dial in and get the small and consider what we could call the microscope view. But let's talk about living cells. So if you're here last week, we said that a lot of people want to talk about creation versus evolution, but even before we do that, you have to talk about origins, like where did all this stuff come from? And, whether it evolved or not, you first have to answer where did it come from, and that we can't do that scientifically. It's just not a scientific question because you can't repeat it in a lab, blah, blah, blah. Here's what we can know scientifically. We do know that proteins are the building blocks of life. We know that it takes about 75 amino acids to form one protein. It takes about 300 to 500 proteins to form the most basic cell, okay? And it's not like you can just throw all those amino acids and proteins into a mixing bowl, stir it up, and life, like chili or like a souffle, it just starts, it's like life. No, what has to happen is you have to line up in an exact, precise sequence all of the information to form a living cell. Like all those amino acids and proteins, they have to be precisely written out in like a code. So DNA uses what's called the genetic alphabet. It's made up of nitrogen bases. And so, for instance, Richard Dawkins is a very outspoken atheist, and he's a scientist. But even he admits that the genetic code found in just the cell nucleus of a tiny, you can't even see it, amoeba, is an encoded message using the genetic alphabet that would fill more than 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Some of the younger people in the room are like, what's an encyclopedia? Is that like the internet? I'm not sure. Encyclopedia, yeah, it's a big book. So if you wrote out the entire genetic message found in a primitive amoeba, it would fill 1,000 complete sets of encyclopedias. Again, these codes are written in a very specific order, just like words in a book, and they have to be completely accurate for life to be healthy and sustainable. I actually talked to somebody after the last service. He graduated not too long ago with a biology degree from college, and he said, you're right, but he's like, you're not saying it strong enough. He said, in my genetic code, all those things that you should have to be exactly right, he said, you're correct, but in my code, he said, there's one letter that's slightly off. So in this encyclopedia, it'd be like one typo in the whole thing, and he said, that's why I have sickle cell anemia. He says, just because there's one letter in all those encyclopedias that kind of had a typo, and I have a disease I could die from because of it. So let me ask you this. Does all that, realizing just a teeny little cell, that it has to all be coded out perfectly, hundreds of volumes of encyclopedias of books, does that point to random chance or to very intelligent design? If it would require, we think, intelligence to write a 15-letter sentence in my alphabet cereal. What does the DNA of a living cell say about the design of our universe? The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. Now, Darwin could not have possibly understood the implications of DNA during his lifetime. They didn't have that kind of science back then. And so he drew conclusions based on the information that he had available to him. But with all we know today about DNA, it is becoming more and more of a stretch to say that all the detailed information necessary for life to come together could have possibly happened by random chance. And it actually is way deeper than that. Okay, we're gonna get a little bit even headier, sorry. So, we said that proteins are the building blocks of life, right? And DNA is the code that builds a protein. So DNA is kind of like the blueprint that comes together to form a protein. Check this out. Turns out we now know proteins rely on DNA for their production But also, DNA relies on proteins for its production. Okay, so proteins rely on DNA. DNA also relies on proteins. So question, how could one of them have evolved before the other? You can give it all the time you want. There's virtually zero chance that both could have happened at the same time. And the implications of this discovery are huge. So there's a guy named Dr. Stephen Meyer. He earned his master's degree and his PhD in molecular biology from Cambridge University. Cambridge is like Harvard of England. And he says, impossible to suggest that DNA led to proteins or that proteins led to DNA. And he says, you simply can't have one without the other. You have to have both of them at the same time. And I know that's really hard to understand. He has an illustration to try to make it a little bit more understandable. He says it like this. Think of a guy falling into a big hole, a huge hole. And he looks up and he realizes, I can't get out of this hole. I cannot climb out of it. It's impossible. What I would need is a really big ladder to get out. So he climbs out, goes and gets a big ladder, brings it back, puts it in the hole, jumps back down into the hole, and climbs out of the hole. Wait a second. That doesn't make sense. It's absurd, right? How can you climb out of a hole to get a ladder to get you out of a hole that you can't climb out of? That can't work. And this scientist is saying, Dr. Meyer is saying, that's exactly what it's like claiming that evolution can possibly explain how proteins and DNA came into the world. Here's another illustration that maybe helps. Imagine a print shop. Again, the younger people are like, what's print? Is it like the stuff on my computer screen? Kinda. So a print shop is like they have millions and bazillions of little letters that would be dipped in ink, right, and print out newspapers and stuff like that. So imagine a print shop with bazillions and bazillions of little letters. Imagine that there's an explosion. All those bazillions and bazillions of letters go flying up in the air. Paper goes flying up in the air. Ink goes flying up in the air. And it all comes down and creates Webster's Dictionary by chance. That all just, it's just like, look at that. It all came in and just completely wrote the dictionary. You'd be like, that can't happen. Okay? So a scientist would say, that's what it's like to say that random chance produced protein or DNA. But here's the problem. Both of them had to evolve at the same time. So what had to happen was the explosion, all the stuff goes flying up in the air. Half of it comes over here and produces Webster Dictionary. And the other half goes and produces, do you like that noise? I don't know what that is. And produces the King James Bible. All at the same time. The explosion produces both right next to each other so they can start working together. It's even more impossible, right? The more complex a design, the more likely a designer. Well, we said last week that science deals with what can be observed. That's what science is all about. It's something that you can put into a lab, repeat and repeat and repeat, do experiments, make hypotheses, and you have to be able to observe it. And that's why some scientists refuse to believe in God. Some scientists say, you know what, if I can't observe God, I only believe in science. I only believe in what I can observe. Here's what's sad, in my opinion. Because of that, they refuse to take an unbiased look at the evidence and just come to the best conclusion. Instead, they start with their conclusion, there is no God, and then they kind of proceed. For instance, there's another scientist named George Wald. He's a Harvard biochemist, which if you ever want to say Harvard biochemist really fast, you say harvest, turns out. Here's what he says. He says, a scientist has no choice but to approach the origin of life through a hypothesis of spontaneous generation. In other words, he's saying that he thinks a scientist cannot even consider the possibility there might be an intelligent designer. You cannot consider the possibility that maybe there could be a God. And so you have to find a way to explain, how did this happen then? How did everything spring from nothing? How did all this complexity happen through random chance and evolution? Wald comes to the conclusion in his writings that time must be the critical ingredient. He writes, given enough time, the impossible, because he admits it's impossible, becomes possible. The possible becomes probable, and the probable becomes virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. So he's saying that life coming about on its own, he says, it's impossible. However, if you give it enough time, the impossible will become possible. Really? There's another scientist. He's a biologist named Francis Crick. He actually won the Nobel Prize. I'm sorry, I've done this three times. This is a lot going on in my head. The Nobel Prize for Science as the co-discoverer of the DNA molecule. He said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. And so he's admitting we are not open to honestly searching for the truth, that we've already made a decision. So when we look at things, certainly it looks like God designed it, but we have to keep in mind, no, there is no God. And we just look for evidence to support the conclusion that we've already come to. Crick was honest enough, and I appreciate this, to admit, he admits, the scientist who discovered DNA, that life on Earth could not possibly have happened by random chance. Many scientists say it's just random chance. Maybe time allowed the miracle to happen. He says, no, it didn't. There's no way that everything sprung from nothing. There is no way random chance created this. There's no way evolution led to the complexities we now have. So you still have to explain it, right, if you're not willing to consider God. So he came up with what he calls the generated panspermia theory, which has got to be one of the worst, ugliest sounding words ever. Panspermia? Ugh. But here's the theory. You ready? He says, basically he says, the first living cell from which we all evolved couldn't have happened by random chance, so it must have been transported to Earth from a planet outside of our solar system. Yes, it was aliens who brought life to Earth. I apologize if I sound frustrated. I don't want to sound that way. But here's part of my frustration. Often, atheists will claim that every time Christians run into a question that they can't answer about science or the universe, that Christians will just say, well, God performed a miracle. That's how Christians try to get out of talking about and answering the tough questions. Well, here we have one scientist saying that time performs miracles. And here we have another scientist who realizes that there's no way this could happen by chance, but refuses to consider the possibility of intelligent design by a creator God. And so he says that life must be transported here by intelligent life from another planet. Okay, but where did that life come from? He refuses to answer that question. He doesn't address it. Really, all he did was he dodged the question of the obviousness of intelligent design by sending it to outer space. And I would just say, for me, the more complex a design, the more likely a designer. We see that every single day. We know that's true, right? And we see it in art and literature and engineering and architecture. And it makes sense to me that it applies to the universe as well. I'm not sure what you would say, but I would wonder if you did come here today kind of more on the agnostic side, thinking, I don't know. I don't know if there might be a God or not. Perhaps hearing all this, maybe you're willing to take the step, and it's a kind of a smaller one, of just becoming a deist, just someone who would say, I think there must be a God. I don't know who that God is, but you look around and there must be some sort of higher intelligence out there somewhere. Next week, we'll see if we can get a little clearer picture of who that God might be, and we'll talk about the possibility, maybe, of just taking one more step from being a deist to just being a theist. But what we're going to do first is pray. And again, I did last week too. I apologize. I realize some of you are probably like, I don't like this. It's not the typical kind of inspirational Bible messages that we normally give. It's very heady and sciencey. I'm sorry. But at least we didn't have spontaneous fires erupting around the room the whole time. So there's always that to be thankful for. So let's be thankful for that and let's pray. God, I want to thank you because I think when I think about what we talked about last week and today and what I know we're going to be talking about the next 2 weeks, I think what's happened is because you love us and because you knew that there would be lots of people, I am certainly one of them, who could never believe without evidence, who could never just have a blind faith, who have this prove it to me or I won't believe it kind of attitude. Because you knew that, you provided tons of evidence. Evidence to believe that there is a God, and we're going to see in the next couple of weeks evidence to trust that the Bible very accurately and honestly reveals who that God is. Evidence to support the fact that Jesus really was your son come to earth to show us your love and to save us. Thank you for the evidence. God, I also thank you because when we think about what we talked about today, this is the vastness of the universe. It's like you have, God, so much to think about, but you think about me. You have so many things to be concerned about, but you are completely concerned about me. You love every single one of us, and what you're doing, you do it through the sunsets and the sunrises, through the ocean, through the Bible, through Jesus. You are wooing us to you. You're trying to romance us. You're trying to draw us into relationship with you because you love us. Thank you, God, that as big as you are, as big as this universe you made is, you care about each one of us so intimately. God, my prayer is that through this series and through everything we do as a church, not just in the weekends, but throughout the week as well, that we would come to know you more and more, and we would come to love you more and more because you love us so much. I pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.